That was a deliberate decision.
He lives somewhere in Colorado now.
Right.
He's an insurance salesman.
That's right. And he was the most marvelous fellow to work with, you can imagine.
Really?
So unforgettably nice. And he used to, you know, hold his own gobo while he did a big acting scene, you know, with one hand looking off that good Western training, you know. I saw hundreds of... I decided it had to be a movie actor, not a stage actor. I don't know why. I can't remember. And I ran every picture you can imagine before I found him. And then I ran all kinds of six-day movies he'd made, besides Backstreet, which I think that was the one, the famous picture he had made.
Yeah.
Before I decided on him, I was so glad. I think it was a very lucky decision.
He had been in Stagecoach, but a small part. He played a...
But he also did an awful lot of the stunts, in which he claimed Ford did everything possible to kill him. He loved Ford. It was said with great affection, but as somebody who's been through the wars, you know, and remembers happily how he escaped death more than once at the hands of the master. And I used to pump him about Ford for hours. He was a small part actor and stuntman. He did a great many of the very difficult stunts in.
Yeah. But what he, but
he's the man who jumps on the horses.
Is that him?
Yes, that's Holt.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah.
When they put
that big
away.
Scene, yes.
But this part in Emerson's was the most important thing he'd really done in terms of size of the role and
course.
So on.
And he could have gone on, decided not to. He deliberately went back to Westerns to make that career and that kind of money. And, the, you know, it was a, and he's in, it was an intelligent man's decision, not an accident that he did.
And well, how did you find Ann Baxter? Wasn't that her first part?
Yes, I think so. I can't really remember. I have a hunch it was. She was the granddaughter of Frank Lloyd Wright, you know.
No, I didn't know.
Yes, who visited us on the set all the time and made withering remarks about the sets, you know. And I kept saying, you know, but Mr. Wright, it's, you know, we agree with you. That's the whole point of these sets. But he couldn't get over how awful it was that people lived in those kind of houses. I couldn't get him quite to see what our intention was.
He didn't understand that you were making a period story.
Yeah, and that the ridiculousness of living in those kind of houses was part of our story. I think he finally got that, but he wanted to sound off a lot on the on the thing and did. He was a superb person.
Was he?
Oh, my God, what a marvelous fellow. And she, I think it was her first picture.
She
but I may be wrong.
Absolutely beautiful.
Terribly beautiful. When the big scene of Aggie Moorhead in the boiler, you know, is only half of what it was because they laughed when they previewed it. I said I'd never previewed a picture, but that picture was previewed.
While you were out of the country.
While I was out of the country, and it got roars of laughter from some stupid Saturday night audience. And they ran scared and cut it in half, and it's still a good scene, but you should have seen it when it went the distance.
Well, yeah. Oh, I see.
You know, it's cold and all that when she, you know,
that's
falls down.
The
hysterical scene when she goes.
Yes,
to pieces.
I know. And that was the scene when she says that great line when he says, "Watch out, you'll burn yourself." And she says, "It's not hot.
Yes,
it's
right.
cold."
Yeah.
Don't forget that. That was much longer.
Yes.
Hmm.
Well, it was not much longer. It was longer and better because it was longer, and they got scared because some idiots laugh, you know.
Mm.
I think any scene that's really disturbing will always make some people laugh on Saturday night.
Sure.
That goes without saying.
Anything disturbing or violent.
That's right. They almost took it out of the picture entirely.
Mm.
They were so worried by the laugh. Imagine, you know. Mm-hmm. Why she didn't get an Academy Award for that performance, I'll never know.
Was one of the great performances.
Mm-hmm.
And she had a lot more that was cut out at the end, didn't she?
Yes.
The rest home.
Yes, a big yes. It turned into the great role of the picture.
And she, one of the scenes, wasn't there a scene when she was sitting in a rest home with the record playing of the old black crows?
Yes, that's right.
Two black crows.
Yeah.
And what happened in that scene, in fact?
Well, that was when Joe Cotton goes to see her after all these years, and there's nothing left between them. That's what it's all about, and it's a story of the deterioration of personality and the awful cliche now, the lack of communication, the end of communication between people, and the end of not only of an era, but of the way people diminish with age. It was terribly, terribly sad and awful. No doubt about it. But it was much the best scene in the whole movie, without question. It towered over everything else.
What was it? Was the two black clothes?
It was totally invented.
As counterpoint?
Yes, part of it. It was just this... Hard to explain how it worked, because there are these awful old people sitting playing bridge in the background and some others listening, all these old people in this sort of half old people's home, half boarding house, which mm-hmm. is with an elevated running by, you know.
I've seen some stills from it that are
I wish the film existed.
The film doesn't exist, you don't think?
Apparently not. I was thinking last night, it made me so sick what you told me about all these old directors who can't get jobs, and I was thinking of these conductors, you know, Klemperer, you know, Barbirolli, Toscanini, I can name 100 almost,
yeah.
in the last century, who were at the height of their powers after 75.
Of course.
And were conducting at 80. And who says you're over the hill?
I know.
It's so awful, but I've always been obsessed by this thing. It's why Lear is my favorite play. I think it's just terrible what happens to old people. And the public isn't interested in it. Never has been. That's why. Yes, please. That's why Lear has always been a play people hate.
Well, your theory about Lear is not that he became senile.
Oh, not at all. He became senile by giving power away. Would you like to see General de Gaulle tomorrow if he'd given it to Pompidou? Become a, you know, a loquacious bore. Saying, you know, where is my minister? Give me my knights, or whatever it is, you know. It's only because he's got France in his hands. The only thing that keeps people alive in their old age is power. And a king, or a conductor, or a director can go as long as there is no cancer or any other breakdown.
Physical breakdown.
Physical, but as long as you can physically do it, you can go on, and now with the new things in 10 or 15 years, you can go on to 120, I'm sure, conducting. Nothing will stop it. It's only the idea in people's minds that will stop it. But take power away from de Gaulle, or Churchill, or Tito, or Mao, or Ho, or any of these old men who were running the world.
Yeah.
In this world that belongs only to young people, you know.
Yeah.
And you'll see a you know, babbling, slippered pantaloons, you know. It's,
yeah. And it's the same thing with
because
the director.
Because it's, yes, of course, and there they are already with their best work ahead of them, I think, if they're any good.
Yeah.
Really their best work.
Yeah.
I believe that Ford today, given a script a little better than anything he's ever done, commanding more from it, would give us better pictures than he has ever made. Because it's only in your 20s and in your 70s and 80s that you do the greatest work. But, you know, the enemy of society is the middle class, and the enemy of life is middle age. It's youth and old age is the great time, and we must treasure old age. And give to genius the capacity to function in old age, and not send them. It's terrible when I think of that.
Oh, horrible. Why not?
Yes, you know, you had such an impression on me. You know why I was sleepless last night? Because you told me about Ford and about people like that who can't You know, they're saying over the hill. And I thought, well, I've got 15 years maybe till they say over the hill. And I suddenly thought, I've got a story that I've worked on for many years, my story of the old director and his last thing. And I am crazy not to do that in preference to anything else, because it's touched some kind of nerve with me, you know.
I don't know that story.
Oh.
You want to tell me?
I don't want to tell it. It'll
blow it for you?
It'll blow it for me. I'll say a few words. He is all the big, macho, hairy-chested fellows, basically Ford, with some Houston Hemingway thrown in his last summer following a bullfighter around Spain with a man who was making a movie about him, a man who was making a book about him, Life, who was making a picture about him, and everything is coming to an end. And you don't know what is the movie, what is the story, what is this.
This is the message.
And it's, you know, and I want to make it with 16 millimeter and blow it up, and I can only do that and not let them know I'm doing it, because if they know it's 16 millimeter, they won't buy it, you know, all those kind of things. Because it can only be made like
phenomenal.
That. It's the best picture I could ever make, you know.
You got to make it right away.
Right away. Forget everything else. That was why I was up all night.
I didn't know that.
Yes, because of what you said about all those, about Ford.
I'm glad
what
I
you said
it.
About Ford got me started. I said that. You know, the terrible thing of a man at the end of his thing. It's one of the big things. Because I'll tell you that if I've ever been really nice in my life, it's always been as a movie and stage director with old actors, with old extras and everything. That is the only area in which I'm a real gentleman. You don't know what I'm like when I know they're going back to that one room, you know. I send them home, they think they've been on a honeymoon, you know. And I did that when I was 20. I've always, to me, they are the great underprivileged minority of the world, are lonely old people, you know.
Sure.
Going away, you know, when they can still do it, you know.
That's right.
Oh.
In our next exchange, the Leo McCarey picture that Orson and I are discussing is his 1937 drama, Make Way for Tomorrow, about an aging married couple. McCarey, as a matter of fact, won the directing Oscar that same year for his comedy, The Awful Truth. And in his acceptance speech, he thanked the Academy and then added, "But you gave it to me for the wrong picture."
McCarey made a very sentimental movie on that subject, but it's damn good.
Oh!
Make
I
Way
went,
for Tomorrow.
I saw it four times and cried my eyes out every time.
Yeah.
And nobody ever went. It only cost $300,000 and lost its negative cost.
Disaster.
Wasn't it wonderful
when
they took that car out and drove around? Oh, my God.
So moving.
Oh, my God. It's one of the best. And that I remembered as a director's picture.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
If you see him again, tell him from me what
I
that
will.
Picture meant.
I will.
Oh. When they went to the car salesman and they took that little drive out, you know. And what's her name? She was good at
Beulah Bondi.
Beulah Bondi. God. And when they had to say goodbye, you know, I think that... Oh, God!
But it's
I went over and over to it.
Yeah.
I thought it was so wonderful.
It's a great thing.
Oh.
Well, I'm very glad I said that to you, because I need you to make that picture.
The picture about the old director, which Orson wanted to make, and which he finally did make, although the editing has still not been completed, was eventually called The Other Side of the Wind.
Would you play the director?
Who should play it? It's John Huston.
Hmm. Oh, I see. You're supposed to be a ballsy sort of...
character. I can do it. You know, I can do it if I can't, you know, if I can't get Houston, there's nobody else but me.
Yeah.
But it really should be Houston saying, listen, kid, you know, all that. It should be all that.
Yeah.
And it's terrible because he's half queer. He has a thing which has to do with, he has discovered male actors all his life. Made five or six great male stars. And his thing is that he has to go to bed with every girl that the male star goes to bed with. And that he has to finally destroy that male star.
So it's a kind of peculiar...
Very. Oh, it's the sickest story I've ever thought up in my life. And at the end, because it's got the boy is a kind of Jimmy Dean character, you know, begins with this wrecked car, which they both died.
Both of them?
Yes. Because at the end, the boy who he's destroyed, he's put into a corrida and let the bull toss him and everything, you know. The boy that he's lost, you know, the boy comes up covered like a mummy with his thing out of it. And he's in the car and he says, come on, Fatso. Want to get in the car? Because that's what Jimmy Dean used to call George Stevens. No, not Fatso. He hated him. Because he's a chicken. And you know that Dean is going off to kill himself in that car, and he gets in the car. Because he has to show he's a man. You know, it's a terrifying story.
It's a hell of a story.
Believe me.
That's the same story.
It's all this, yeah.
And it's a lot of very complex.
Hey, oh, boy, it's so great. You don't know where you are. It's so
have
complex.
You written the screenplay?
I've written four of them.
I've heard about this. I've heard you talk about this, but I thought it was a bullfighting story.
You never see a bullfight in this story.
Oh, I see.
You only see them in the bull ring, looking at the bull ring. You never see a bull.
Mm-hmm.
Never see a bullfighter except in his hotel room.
Yeah.
It's always big macho thing, you know, which I'm so fed up with, you know. Although I love it, Andre Ambezalver, you know. I love Ford, and also I think it's a lot of shit that he hits
Fonda.
Fonda, and I love Hemingway, and I think it's a lot of shit.
Yeah.
It's all that, you know.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah.
And I love this man, mm-hmm. and I hate him, and that's what I think is great about this story. I want to love him and hate him and show him and all that thing, you know.
It would be wonderful if you cast
you know.
Ford in the...
No, because he is not... It's Houston is the best, and I'm the second best. It has to be...
Why don't you keep him here in Houston? Or are you and he not that friendly?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very. Truly, very. The only thing against him in it, he doesn't give the feeling of violence.
No, he's
some
rather...
of the scenes he can do much better than I can, but some I can do better because you can believe that I would put my money on the mantelpiece and fight the other fellow,
mm-hmm.
you know?
Mm-hmm.
And there's something about Houston which is a little clerical. You know, he's like an unfrocked priest a little, you know.
He is, yeah.
And we'll see. You know. But, oh, it's my best story. And it has to be ad-libbed. The picture has to be made. I have to take the cast away for 6 weeks and tell them the story and talk with them. It's a cast of only about 6 people. And then we go into the temporada with 3 or 4 cameras, many of which show because they're making a movie about this man.
It doesn't matter, yeah. Mm-hmm.
You know, and you don't know what's the movie or not. You know, they're doing one of those portrait Reichenbach things, you know.
Yeah.
And somebody else is like you, you know.
It's this thing, yeah.
You know, and somebody else is, the girl, like Candice Bergen, and all that's going.
Mm-hmm.
And he's right at the end, and they're trying to bite off a piece of it like they were at Hemingway at the end when he was just a symbol and nothing else, and he knows it. And he's got the boy, he's got a terrible scene, begins with a terrible scene of the boy who's already fired, who has to be destroyed, and he has a dummy of the boy to be destroyed in some awful way. And it doesn't work at the beginning, and this truck is, and he has to get to pick up that one shot, and this truck with all the dummies of the boy is traveling all around, and you keep seeing these boys set up and being destroyed again, and he doesn't like it, you know. Isn't it?
Great.
Isn't it? Really, I got to be down here.
Oh, God, it's great.
It's terrifying. And it's right for now.
What's the story? What's the title?
I never have a title. I told you, I've only made up one title in my life.
When Orson later came to make this picture, he discarded all the bullfighting elements, but kept most of the original concept just as he describes it here. In this conversation, I was comparing Richard Bennett's final scene as old Mr. Amberson by the fireplace with the first scene of the aging men by the fire in Chimes at Midnight.
There's a moment in Chimes at Midnight that recalls that moment to me.
Right? Oh, with the when we're sitting at the beginning and
looking at the fire.
Yeah.
Old men contemplating their death.
Yeah, I guess that does.
That wasn't conscious.
No, I hate it when I repeat myself like that, but I'm afraid you're right. It never occurred to me. But except there was an obvious place for it. The only place we could sit in that room that I found was in front of what ought to have been a fireplace. I originally thought of that scene in Chimes at Midnight, and until 3 days before we shot it, it was going to have been in the skeleton of an orchard, you know, with black trees and the snow. And we were going to be, the two old men besides Falstaff were going to be roasting some little birds over a brazier. Mm-hmm. No fire, they were just getting something to eat, and a sort of terrible little greasy-fingered old men scene. So we really weren't going to be staring at the fire. We only did because we couldn't get any snow. And David Lean, making Zivago next door to us, took off for Finland, and I went indoors and did the scene in front of a fireplace. So if it echoes Amberson's, it's just because in the time available, yeah, there didn't seem any other way to do old men.
Well, it was a nice scene anyway.
Yeah. They're very good in it. They're both
great.
Yes.
Yeah, marvelous. Yeah. And a wonderful actor who can't talk.
Yeah, Walter Chiari.
Oh, he was good.
Yes, he's a great character. He's a marvelous performer.
That must be your character. That's nothing like that in Shakespeare.
No. No, it's but he's called Silence, you know, and it seemed to me it was a good cue to make him incapable of speech by version of a horrible stutter.
And you made him funny looking with a wide lens, didn't you, or something?
And I made him up. He had the both of them had. I put on fake noses and cotton under his cheeks and all that myself. And created this kind of, I hate that word created, made that kind of mask.
Yeah.
And he's a superb actor and low comedian. He's a great star of reviews, you know.
I know the name when you said it. I don't think I'd...
Good-looking ex-football player, very husky, strong, handsome Italian.
It's such a moving film, you know. Every time I see one of your pictures, it sort of takes me a few weeks to recover. Literally, because I remember having seen Lady from Shanghai the first time, and I sort of went around in a daze for a few days, you know, trying to... the world looks wrong, and your movie looks right.
Well, it's nice to hear, because after most of them, and particularly I remember Lady from Shanghai, nobody that I know wants to mention it. Everybody was so embarrassed about Lady from Shanghai after it came out here. I was living in Los Angeles and visiting in New York, and whenever the name would be mentioned, people would clear their throats and change the subject very quickly to save me embarrassment. You know, I only found out that it was considered a good picture when I got over in Europe.
Oh, it's a great picture.
Because now it's considered all right, but my God, you should have heard the talk then.
Yeah, that's what's called being ahead of your time.
I don't know what it's called. It's called being in trouble anyway.
Yeah. But you didn't feel it was a bad picture, did you?
No, I didn't feel it was a bad picture. I was terribly sorry that for what Cohen did, not to the cutting, to the soundtrack. That's a picture that was ruined for me to a great extent by what happened on the soundtrack, because he didn't change the cutting of the picture. It's virtually as I cut it. But I made a temporary soundtrack for previews out of stock music. And then instead of allowing me to get a composer who would work with me, or using the temporary one, he got in a fast fellow who did a terrible score very quickly, which was laid in place of all the sound effects I had. And for example, the big mirror scene at the end was absolutely silent with just the crashing glass and everything, and instead there's some terrible corny choir of strings going on under it. You can imagine how much better that would have been if a radio director had been allowed to have his head in how the soundtrack should be. That's the only harm done to that, but it was pretty drastic all the way through.
Yeah.
Very, very corny soundtrack and music track.
I didn't notice it, you would notice it. And I saw it a few times, but that would have been great. It's still a great picture, I think.
He was very interesting about that at the end of the picture. Korn said to me, you know, I'm never going to make a picture like this with you again. He said that in front of about 20 people at an executive's lunch. And his reason was very interesting and very fair, and I couldn't feel offended, because he says, it's not because you went over budget, you didn't, and it's not because it isn't a good script. It's a script we approved, and I like it. I don't care what anybody says. It's because nobody should be the director and producer and leading actor in a picture, because that puts the head of the studio in the position of being a janitor. There's no way you can be fired.
He was right.
He was right.
I was reminded of something on Chimes at Midnight, though. How was it? Oh, well, I was struck again by your remarkable restraint and economy of expression, and the emotion of the picture was so restrained, I thought. And it was terribly moving film, you know. But all the emotional scenes were very much held in check and very much, very unsprawling. You know, you're often accused of being...
I know. Particularly by my best defenders in Europe, they always speak of... Oh, yes, eloquent and all of that, but the complete lack of measure and balance. And
I just,
all
it's just the opposite, I think, in all your pictures. I mean, beginning with Kane, the few moments that bring tears in the picture, and there are about five or six that never fail to make me cry, are handled with incredible restraint. And they're all just little looks that do it. I mean, when Agnes Moorehead opens the window and calls for her son at the beginning.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing.
That moment.
Yeah, that's my favorite thing.
So moving every time.
Because she was so great at it.
Yeah.
But...
And then the moment when she said, you say, you know what mothers are, and she says, you know what mothers are, and you say, yes, that moment there is very moving to me, too. And some others in the picture, but they're all very little moments, and they're not at all emotional. And it's the same in Chimes at Midnight or Falstaff, that moment at the end is played, I mean, almost Spartan, the way you play that last moment with Henry.
I think it must be. It's such a tremendous moment. You can't possibly spoil it, but it has to be treasured. It's too delicate, I think, for actors to get rough with.
Well, you did just about nothing except smile a little bit, and your chin shook a little, and it was terribly moving, I thought.
And that's a great scene. Because the whole movie's a preparation for that scene, too, and it works, because in a way that it can never in the theater, because you have to go to three different plays to see how it prepares for it.
Yeah.
That's really the point of making the three plays.
Go together.
Go together, so that scene will have that impact.
And there are other scenes in the movie that anticipate that scene. I mean, there's
constantly, yes.
Constantly.
Yes.
And you always play the anticipatory lines lightly. In fact, you play them for comedy most.
Yes.
Like that line when he says, banish Fat Jack and banish all the world, and there's an exchange there.
When you suddenly know that it's going to happen.
Going to happen.
Yeah, that's right.
It's really
it makes my it. Makes my gives me goose pimples every time I think of that situation. It never fails to move me just thinking of it.
Did you feel in making the film, or in your approach to the story, that Hal was wrong?
No. He's neither wrong nor right. I don't make those judgments about people ever in my pictures.